Chapter 12. The White Proletariat in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. How in those southern states where Negroes formed a minority, there ensued strife between planters, poor whites, Negroes, and carpetbaggers, which after varying forms of alliance, finally ended in the subjection of black labor. We have studied Reconstruction in three states where the preponderance of Negro population and the political part which it played during Reconstruction makes it fair to say that the Negro during part of the time exercised a considerable dictatorship over the state governments of South Carolina, Mississippi, and Louisiana. In these states, the material for studying the participation of the Negro in Reconstruction is large, although by no means complete. We now come to states where the Negro population is large, but where from the beginning the political influence of the Negro was comparatively small. In Virginia, North Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, Arkansas, Texas, and the border states, the interests of black labor were never in the ascendant. But from the first, there was a battle between carpetbaggers and planters to control white and black labor. For a time, the ancient breach between planters and poor whites gave control to carpetbaggers and scalawags, supported by Negroes. But war and poverty had depleted the old planter families, and some poor whites, eager for land and profits, and jealous of Negroes, came to join the planters. They gradually drove the carpetbaggers to the wall and took forcible control of colored labor with the help of the whole labor vote, which they controlled. The carpetbaggers made the hardest fight in North Carolina, Alabama, and Georgia. Alabama had 85,451 whites when it entered the Union in 1820, and 42,450 Negroes. By 1860, there were 526,271 whites and 437,770 Negroes. There was competition for appointment to the provisional governorship of Alabama, but Lewis E. Parsons was appointed June 1, 1865. He called an election for a convention based on white suffrage. The convention in September admitted that the institution of slavery has been destroyed in the state of Alabama. It adjourned September 30th, and the legislature met November 20th. This legislature adopted the 13th Amendment, with the understanding that it does not confer upon Congress the power to legislate upon the political status of freedmen in this state. The Black Code, adopted by the legislature, was one of the most severe in the South. Most of these laws, however, were vetoed by Governor R. M. Patton, who saw the reaction in the North and was trying to keep in careful touch with Washington. He warned the lawmakers that the Negro was at work, and that such severe legislation was not needed. Patton said with regard to these bills, "I have carefully examined the laws which under this bill would be applied to the freedmen, and I think that a mere recital of some of these provisions will show the impolicy and injustice of enforcing it upon the Negroes in their new condition." The final code contained the usual provisions for vagrancy, apprenticeship, enticing labor, etc., but was drawn without obvious color discrimination, although there naturally was that, in fact. The chief characteristic of Reconstruction in Alabama was the direct fight for mastery between the poor whites and the planters. The poor whites of Alabama were largely segregated in the northern part of the state. A correspondent of The Nation, who traveled among them in August 1865, said, "They are ignorant and vindictive, live in poor huts, drink much, and all use tobacco and snuff. They want to organize and receive recognition by the United States government in order to get revenge, really want to be bushwhackers supported by the federal government. They wish to have the power to hang, shoot, and destroy in retaliation for the wrongs they have endured. They hate the big nigger holders, whom they accuse of bringing on the war and who they are afraid would get into power again. They are the refugee, poor white element of low character, shiftless, with no ambition." The poor whites won their first victory after the Constitution of 1865, when a law was passed providing for a census in 1866 and for apportionment of senators and representatives according to the white population. The delegates from the white counties of North and Southeast Alabama voted in favor of this, and 30 white delegates from the Black Belt voted against it. This measure destroyed the political power of the Black Belt, and if the Johnson government had survived, the state would have been ruled by the white counties instead of by the black counties. The planters were thus thrown into involuntary alliance with Negro labor, and the matter of Negro suffrage was discussed. The planters were sure they could control the Negro vote, while the poor white merchants and farmers opposed Negro voters. Brooks, once president of the Secession Convention of 1861, and a brother of Bully Brooks of South Carolina, who nearly killed Sumner, introduced a bill in the lower house providing for a qualified Negro suffrage based on education and property. He represented Lowndes County in the Black Belt. This bill was endorsed by Governor Patton and Judge Goldthwaite, but there were two difficulties. First, the unbending opposition of the triumphant poor whites, and secondly, the suspicion of the planters themselves that their ability to dictate to the blacks was not so certain. The movement did not get far. From 1865 to 1868, and even later, there was, for all practicable purposes, over the greater part of the people of Alabama, no government at all. From 1865 to 1874, government and respect for government were weakened to a degree from which it has not yet recovered. The people governed themselves extra-legally and have not recovered from the practice. In 1866, the Negroes held a convention in Mobile and complained of lawless aggression and the refusal of the legislature to receive their petitions. There was continual fear of insurrection in the Black Belt. This vague fear increased toward Christmas, 1866. The Negroes were disappointed because of the delayed division of lands. There was a natural desire to get possession of firearms, and all through the summer and fall, they were acquiring shotguns, muskets, and pistols in great quantities. In several instances, the civil authorities, backed by the militia, searched Negro houses for weapons and sometimes found supplies which were confiscated. The final condition of Alabama was difficult. There was not only loss of slaves, destruction, and deterioration of property, but the cotton tax and war confiscation fell heavily on this cotton section. The cotton spirited away by thieves and confiscated by the government would have paid several times over all the expenses of the army and the Freedmen's Bureau during the entire time of the occupation. Many times as much money was taken from the Negro tenant in the form of this cotton tax as was spent in aiding him. At the end of the war, at least 5,000 Northern men were in Alabama engaged in trade and farming. They brought with them a good deal of capital, and since cotton was selling for 40 cents to 50 cents a pound, they naturally expected to make large profits. After the Reconstruction laws, these capitalists sought to control the labor vote. Encouraged by them, the Negroes called a convention in Mobile, which met in May 1867. The convention declared itself in favor of the party of the new capitalists and asked protection in their civil rights and schools supported by a property tax. They declared that it was the undeniable right of the Negro to hold office, sit on juries, ride in public conveyances, and visit places of public amusement. That same month, Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts made a political speech in Montgomery to a great crowd of black and white people. He made a plea for cooperation between whites and Negroes. The Confederates objected that this would lead to a union of alien capitalists and colored people, and the state thus would be taken out of the control of natives. Later, May 14th, when Judge Kelly of Pennsylvania tried to speak in Mobile, there was a race riot. General Pope wrote in 1867 from Alabama, "It may be safely said that the marvelous progress made in the education of these people, aided by the noble charitable contributions of Northern societies and individuals, finds no parallel in the history of mankind. If continued, it must be by the same means, and if the masses of the white people exhibit the same indisposition to be educated that they do now, 5 years will have transferred intelligence and education, so far as the masses are concerned, to the colored people of this district. His district included Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi. In July, General Clanton formed the Conservative Party of Alabama, and knowing what this represented in reaction, there was a widespread desire among colored people around Montgomery to prevent the meeting of this convention. A few leading colored people formed themselves into a special committee and resolved that they would use all the influence they may choose to counteract any acts of violence to the convention. The result was that the meeting was held without the fact being known that there was any movement against it. In the election under the Reconstruction laws, 61,295 Negroes and 104,518 whites registered. But of the whites, only 18,533 voted in favor of a convention. In the convention were 31 Northerners, of whom 18 were officials of the Freedmen's Bureau and 18 Negroes. The rest were Southern whites. The Alabama Negroes had few educated leaders in their ranks and were, in the main, poor, ignorant field hands. The Negro members of the convention are noted as follows. Ben Alexander of Green, field hand. John Carraway of Mobile, assistant editor of the Mobile Nationalist. Thomas Diggs of Barber, field hand. Peyton Finley, formerly doorkeeper of the House. James K. Green of Hale, a carriage driver. Ovid Gregory of Mobile, a barber. Jordan Hatcher of Dallas. Washington Johnson of Russell, field hand. L. S. Lathan of Bullock. Tom Lee of Perry, field hand, who had a reputation for moderation. Alfred Strother of Dallas, and J. T. Rapier of Lauderdale. Rapier was educated in Canada and was a man of power. Several of his proposals are embodied in the present Constitution of Alabama. Of these members, two were well educated, and one, Rapier, a national leader. About half could not write. Nevertheless, their actions, their votes, and their speeches were encouraging. They were, as in practically all cases, conservative and willing to follow leadership. The debates touched the disfranchisement of Confederate leaders, mixed schools, and intermarriage. Many white people at this time proposed to leave the state, but the elections of 1867 in the North encouraged them, especially the defeat of Negro suffrage in several states. The majority of the scalawags were ready to revolt after finding that the carpetbag element had control of the Negro vote. The Negroes, with a few exceptions, made no unreasonable and violent demands unless urged by the carpetbaggers. The carpetbaggers, with a few extreme scalawags, are disposed to resort to extreme measures of proscription in order to get rid of white leaders and white majorities and to agitate the question of social equality in order to secure the Negroes and to drive off the scalawags. The debates on suffrage were long, and many took part. Dustin White, formerly of Iowa, proposed that the new Constitution should admit former rebels to the ballot, but his resolution was voted down by a vote of 30-51. Some of the Negroes voted for it. Rapier proposed that the convention memorialize Congress to remove the political disabilities of those who might aid in Reconstruction according to the plan of Congress. This was adopted, and Griffin, a radical member, was made chairman of the committee to make these recommendations. The majority report to the committee did not wish to go beyond the acts of Congress in disfranchising former Confederates, but attempts were made to disfranchise all Confederates above the rank of captain and all who held any civil office anywhere. Sisby wanted to exclude from suffrage those who had killed Negroes during the last 2 years, or opposed Reconstruction, or persuaded voters not to take part in the election. It was finally settled that in addition to those disfranchised by the Reconstruction Acts, others should be excluded for violation of the rules of war. Such persons could neither register, vote, nor hold office until relieved by the vote of the General Assembly and until they had accepted the civil and political equality of men. Lee, Negro, said that such a course would endanger the ratification of the Constitution, and if the Negroes did not get their rights now, they would never get them. He wanted his rights at the courthouse and at the polls, and nothing more. The colored representative of Dallas County demanded that the Negroes be empowered to collect pay from those who held them in slavery at the rate of $10 per month for service rendered from January 1, 1863, the date of the Emancipation Proclamation, to May 20, 1865. An ordinance to this effect was adopted by a vote of 53-31. The scalawags, as a rule, wished to prohibit intermarriage of the races, and Semple of Montgomery reported an ordinance to that effect. Carraway, a Negro, wanted life imprisonment for any white man marrying or living with a black woman, but he said it was against the Civil Rights Bill to prohibit intermarriage. Gregory, a Negro of Mobile, wanted all regulations, laws, and customs wherein distinctions were made on account of color or race to be abolished. Carraway succeeded in having an ordinance passed, directing that church property used during slavery for colored congregations be turned over to the latter. Some of the property was paid for by Negro slaves and held in trust for them by white trustees. Some of it had belonged to the planters who had erected churches for the use of their slaves. The Negro members demanded free schools and special advantages for the Negro, and a few carpetbaggers spoke of the malign influence of the old regime in keeping so many thousands in ignorance. The scalawags demanded separate schools for the races, but pressure was brought to bear, and most of them gave way. 16 of the native whites finally refused to sign the Constitution and united in a protest against the action of the convention in refusing to provide separate schools. The protest said that the Constitution agreed upon tended to the abasement and degradation of the white population of the state because it authorized mixed schools and because the convention had refused to prohibit the intermarriage of the races. The protest pointed out, as evidencing the degree in which leading white Republicans deferred to their colored colleagues, that though the Judiciary Committee had unanimously reported a measure providing against amalgamation, yet the convention tabled it, and many members of the committee, who had concurred in the report of the committee, receding from their position, voted to lay it on the table. The Constitution was adopted by the convention by a vote of 66-6, 26 not voting. Just before the convention adjourned, Carraway, a Negro, offered a resolution, which was adopted, stating that the Constitution was founded on justice, honesty, and civilization, and the enemies of law and order, freedom and justice, were pledged to prevent its adoption. This Constitution was afterward repudiated by the Convention of 1875, when the Negroes had been driven from political power. Nevertheless, it was a more modern and democratic instrument than any of the preceding constitutions of the state, and the new Constitution of 1875 retained many of its provisions. On the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of February, 1868, the new Constitution was to be voted on. According to the Reconstruction Act, the adoption of the Constitution required a majority of the registered vote. A conference of conservatives was held in Montgomery January 1st. It was decided that as many as possible should register and then stay away from the polls. The time of voting was extended to 5 days. The Constitution received 70,812 affirmative votes and only 1,005 negative. Yet this was not a majority of the registered vote, so that the plan of the conservatives was successful. However, Congress changed the law so as to make a majority of the vote cast valid for adopting the Constitution and thus declared it adopted. Alabama was admitted to the Union June 25th. On July 13th, the General Assembly convened. The 14th Amendment was ratified, and William H. Smith elected governor. The legislature held 3 sessions during 1868, on July 13th, September 16th, and November 2nd. There were 26 Negroes in the House and 1 in the Senate. One of the first things that the legislature did by means of the Negro votes was to relieve the disabilities of those disfranchised by the state constitution. In 1869, a general state system of schools was put into operation, and the private schools of Mobile merged into the system. November 25th, the 15th Amendment was ratified. At the beginning of the Reconstruction government, the debt of the state was $8,355,683. At the first session of the legislature, there was no important legislation. But at the second session of the legislature, the previous custom of Alabama of aiding railroads was taken up, and the aid increased from $12,000 to $16,000 a mile. The argument was that under the old law, capitalists had not been attracted, but that now they would come in. Under this law, there was a good deal of waste of money through railroads failing to complete building for which they had been paid. These railroad acts were adopted by votes of men of both parties, the first by the Democratic Provisional Legislature of 1867, and those of 1868 to 1879 by the Republicans. Additional aid to one railroad was opposed, and many charges of corruption made. Railroad building increased in Alabama. In 1860, there were 743 miles. In 1867, 851 miles. In 1871 to 1872, 1,697 miles were completed, with other lines in construction. The cost of the miles completed, with equipment, was over $60 million. One peculiarity of the dispute about railroad legislation during Reconstruction is that money secured on the credit of the state was controlled and spent very largely by Southern men. The question, therefore, of the liability of the states in the future to pay such of these debts as the railway corporations did not pay was really, in most cases, a question as to how far Southern people were going to conduct railroads so as to pay debts owed their own state. Thus, the large contingent railway debts of North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, and Georgia would not have been debts at all if Southern people had handled investments efficiently and wisely. Yet their failure to do this enabled them to make the charge of extravagance against the carpetbaggers all the greater. Election for governor and for the lower house in the legislature was held in November 1870. Lindsay, a Democrat, was elected in November, and after some contest with the Republican incumbent, was seated. His administration was admittedly not a success, and there was as much railroad graft as ever. In 1872, Lewis, a Republican, was elected, but two bodies, one Democratic and the other Republican, both claimed to be the legislature of the state. The Democrats met at the State House, and the Republicans at the United States Courthouse. Both appealed to the president, and December 11, 1872, the president submitted an unofficial plan for compromise. The Republicans finally secured a majority in both houses. In 1874, the debt, including railroad bonds, amounted to $25,503,593. There were conflicts between whites and blacks during the election, but the Democrats carried all the state officers and had majorities in both houses of the legislature. A new constitution was adopted. The number of officers was cut down, and the salaries, and the school funds were seriously curtailed, and the system weakened. The Ku Klux Klan was rampant in Alabama. In one district, six churches were burned by incendiaries before the election of 1870. Many schoolhouses were burned. Between 1868 and 1871, there were 371 cases of violence, including 35 murders. The planters and poor whites, after their first enmity, early made alliance in Alabama, and their concentrated social weight descended on whites who dared to vote with the blacks. Such persons were warned and attacked until they fled the state or made peace with the new masters. Later, northern capital poured into the poor white belt to develop coal and iron. Convict labor was widely used, and exploitation developed, with labor divided by race and helpless. It is absolutely essential, declared a great Negro convention in Montgomery, December 1874, to our protection and our civil and political rights, that the laws of the United States shall be enforced so as to compel respect and obedience for them. Before the state laws and state courts, we are utterly helpless. The force acts were failing, and to the Negro, the question presented by the failure of their execution was whether his constitutional rights as a citizen were to be a reality or a mockery, a protection and a boon, or a danger and a curse, whether they were to be freemen in fact or only in name, whether the last two amendments to the Constitution were to be practically enforced or to become nullities and stand only as dead letters on the statute books. The state of Georgia had in 1790 52,886 whites and 29,662 Negroes. The increase was rapid, but fairly uniform up until 1850, when there were 384,613 Negroes and 521,572 whites. In 1860, this had increased to 465,698 Negroes and 591,550 whites. There were, in 1860, 3,500 free Negroes in the state. The assets of the state of Georgia in 1860 included $600 million of taxable property, besides stocks in banks and railroads amounting to about $800,000. The state debt in 1861, including nearly $15 million worth of currency, came to a total of $18,035,775. Georgia lost 40,000 of its white population during the war. Georgia clung to slavery. Howell Cobb wrote in June 1865, "The institution of slavery, in my judgment, provided the best labor system that could be devised for the Negro race." He had his capital invested in thousands of Negroes and hundreds of acres of land in middle and southwestern Georgia. In 1866, there was a sufficient migration of Negroes from Georgia to the West to cause some alarm. The Georgia Land and Immigration Company was formed in 1865 to encourage white immigrants. It was not successful. Some who came demanded better wages and were dissatisfied with the food. The project was given up. By May 1866, 1,200 citizens of Georgia had received special pardons from the president under the $20,000 exemption clause, and as early as 1865 and 1866, there was evident in Georgia a transition of leadership from the old landed aristocracy to the new commercial class. In June, James Johnson, a lawyer of Columbus, was appointed provisional governor of Georgia instead of Joshua Hill, who had been strongly urged, and had urged himself. Former Governor Brown had summoned the state legislature, acting on the assumption that the state was already restored. The state legislature was prevented from assembling by military order, and Brown resigned the governorship. He had, however, great influence with Andrew Johnson, and may have been one of the influences that changed Johnson from severe to moderate measures toward the rebels. Elections for the convention were held in October 1865. Nearly 300 delegates assembled at Milledgeville, of whom the great majority were insignificant men. They were a conservative body, unprogressive, mostly old men and rising politicians. This convention repealed but refused to nullify the ordinance of secession and abolished slavery with the proviso that this acquiescence in the action of the government of the United States is not intended to operate as a relinquishment, waiver, or estoppel of such claim for compensation or loss sustained by reason of the emancipation of his slaves, as any citizen of Georgia may hereafter make upon the justice and magnanimity of that government. The convention adjourned, and in the November election, C.J. Jenkins was elected governor after Alexander Stevens and former Governor Brown had refused to be candidates. The legislature convened in Milledgeville in December 1865 and elected two leading former Confederates, Alexander Stevens and H.V. Johnson, as senators. President Johnson wanted Governor Johnson, and Joshua Hill greatly desired the place. The New York Times regretted that two men had been selected, apparently because of their prominence in the rebellion. The first work of the legislature was a series of 11 laws, which formed the Black Code. Georgia, however, under ex-Governor Brown's advice, was more careful than the other states and listened to the storm of criticism against the other Black Codes. The Black Code contained an apprentice law in the usual form, a vagrancy law with heavy penalties, various alterations in the penal laws, and laws about the enticing of labor. Civil rights were established for Negroes, giving them the right to testify in courts, but only where colored people were concerned. Every colored child hereafter born was declared the legitimate child of his mother and also of his colored father, if acknowledged by that father. Alexander Stevens suggested extending the franchise to the Negro after he had reached a certain cultural standard and acquired an amount of wealth, but no one paid the slightest attention to this proposal. The 14th Amendment was rejected in 1866 unanimously in both houses. In the summer of 1867, Toombs suddenly returned from Europe, where he had been hiding. He declared, "I regret nothing in the past but the dead and the failure. And I am ready today to use the best means I can command to establish the principles for which I fought." The Negro early began to organize. Meetings were held in Macon and in Savannah, and a particularly large convention was assembled in Augusta in 1866 before the Reconstruction legislation. There were over 100 delegates from 18 counties. James Porter was elected president, and the convention went on record as not asking universal suffrage, but advocating property and educational tests as qualifications for the right to vote. It appointed a board to look after the education of the Negroes within the state, and finally formed itself into a body to be called the Equal Rights Association of Georgia. The platform of the association sought to inculcate principles of honesty, industry, and sobriety among Negroes and a kindly feeling toward former masters. Negroes were advised to work hard, to learn to read and write, and to buy homes. There were two other important resolutions passed. One, that the cost lands held by Negroes were not to be guarded as territories, and that land was not to be confiscated from its owners. The other, that the Georgia legislature should give equal rights to Negroes before the courts. Another meeting was held in Macon, March 26, 1867, 2 months after the Reconstruction Acts. The Macon Telegraph carried a long account of this gathering. The meeting was to be held at the Second Colored Baptist Church, but this was not large enough, and it convened in a grove near Rose Hill Cemetery. Here, a huge platform was erected for the speakers, federal officials, and school teachers. There were speeches by white and colored men, and the procession carried banners. On one banner was the inscription, "As we have got to live and vote together in one state, let us be friends." This was followed by another meeting in Savannah. On the platform were ex-Governor Johnson, several army officers, and three colored men. Ex-Governor Johnson was made president. Five resolutions were passed recognizing the power of Congress, the enfranchisement of colored people, the education of the whole people as of the highest importance, and early registration and election for the convention. The last of this series of meetings was held in Augusta, with an attendance of 1,000 people. Again, ex-Governor Johnson was the principal speaker, but the meeting was not quite as harmonious as the former meetings. In the other meetings, there had been evidently a careful attempt to reconcile the desires of the white and colored people, but in this meeting, the wishes of the colored people were more frankly expressed. The resolutions asked for equal political rights and the abolition of corporal punishment. White papers reported that many intelligent colored men disapproved of the spirit of the resolutions, but this was evidently white propaganda. When the military reconstruction of Georgia was ordered by General Pope, Governor Jenkins went to Washington to seek an injunction before the Supreme Court on the part of the state of Georgia against the Secretary of War, General Grant, and General Pope. His petition was dismissed May 13th for want of jurisdiction. Later, the governor returned to Washington, carrying the great seal of the state and about $400,000 in cash, which disappeared. He filed a bill of complaint in the Supreme Court against General Grant, General Meade, and others for illegal seizure of the property of the state and again asked for an injunction, but was unsuccessful. General Pope gave Negroes the right to serve on juries in August, and in January he was removed by President Johnson and General Meade substituted. In the registration under the Reconstruction laws, 93,457 Negroes registered and 95,214 whites. This meant that the whites were registering in spite of the advice of leading men like Ben Hill. Joseph Brown, on the other hand, counseled the whites not to let the newcomers and Negroes sweep on to victory unopposed, and Brown's advice was evidently followed. Notwithstanding this, 24,000 Negroes were persuaded or intimidated into not voting, and 60,000 whites did not take part. While it is often stated that the great mass of white people were debarred by the Reconstruction Acts, it is notable in Georgia that the average vote before the war was 102,585, while the registration of whites was 95,214. Thus, those debarred from registering were estimated at between 7,000 and 10,000. The convention met in Atlanta on December 9, 1867, and sat until the middle of March, 1868. Of the 169 delegates to the convention, 37 were Negroes, 9 were white carpetbaggers, and 12 conservative whites. The great majority, then, were native whites. This convention, therefore, was not controlled by carpetbaggers and Negroes, but by native whites. A reporter of the Savannah News, December 14, 1867, declared that the Negroes in the convention appeared well-dressed and well-behaved with few expectations. The convention was interested in suffrage, qualifications for office-holding, relief, and a liberal constitution. In these matters, Negroes took active part in the discussions and used their political privilege intelligently and with caution. Among the most capable colored members of this meeting were Aaron A. Bradley, Tunis George Campbell, J.B. Costin, and Henry McNeil Turner. Bradley was a fighter and attacked both Democrats and Republicans when they tried to coerce the Negroes. He was therefore given much publicity as a dangerous and undesirable Negro who would cause trouble. Bradley had a colorful and eventful career and was a man of great eloquence, and the Negroes could not be made to lose confidence in him. He attacked racial discrimination on public carriers and requested the general in command to have the jails and prisons examined so as to release persons unlawfully deprived of their liberties. Bradley left the convention because of charges that he had deceived Negroes on an island off the coast of Savannah. As a matter of fact, he was trying to protect their land, and they had so much confidence in him that they sent him back as senator in 1888. Turner was the most prominent of the Negroes. He was born in South Carolina in 1833 and was appointed chaplain in the army by President Lincoln. He was a preacher in the African M.E. Church, of which he eventually became bishop. In 1865, he was appointed to the Freedmen's Bureau in Georgia. He traveled over the whole state, and when he became a part of the Republican organization in 1867, was well known for his speeches in all parts of Georgia. Turner was not liked by the whites. The Atlanta Intelligencer called him an unscrupulous fellow, shrewd enough to deceive the poor, deluded Negro. He had to withstand all sorts of attempts to involve him in difficulties. He said that the whites accused him of every crime in the catalog of villainy. "I have even been arrested and tried on the wildest and most groundless accusations ever distilled from the laboratory of hell." He was acquitted, however, in every case. Turner, nevertheless, sought to win the confidence of the conservatives. He tried to prevent the sale of property on which owners were unable to pay taxes, and he introduced a resolution for the relief of banks. Both these passed the convention. He desired civil rights, but did not wish the downfall of the aristocracy. There was enthusiasm in his efforts to secure pardon for Jefferson Davis. He tried to secure internal improvements by state action rather than by private companies. As a member of the Education Committee, he sought to insert provisions that 5 years after the common school system had come into full operation, no person on becoming 21 years of age should vote unless he possessed an educational qualification. Another Negro leader was Tunis Campbell. He was born in Massachusetts and came south as an agent of the Freedmen's Bureau. He first established himself on an island off the coast of Savannah, where he established his own government. An armed force was necessary to remove him. He then went to Darien, where he acquired wide control over the Negroes and virtually ruled them. In the Constitutional Convention, he was particularly interested in relief, seeking unsuccessfully to abolish imprisonment for debt. The convention prohibited slavery, established a single citizenship without discrimination, and gave the right to vote to all males born or naturalized in the United States and resident in Georgia 6 months. In laying down qualifications for voters, it was said especially that all voters should be eligible to office. This stipulation was afterward stricken out by an almost unanimous vote on the ground that it was unnecessary. This was probably a trick engineered by ex-Governor Brown for election purposes and was the basis of the subsequent expulsion of colored men from the legislature. In the Constitution, a general system of education free to all children of the state was provided. There was no attempt to disqualify Confederates for office beyond the demands of the Reconstruction Acts. The convention devoted much of its efforts at first toward relief from taxes, foreclosures, executions for debt, etc. On April 20, 1868, the Constitution was adopted by a majority of 17,699 votes, and Rufus B. Bullock was elected governor. Bullock is usually classed as a carpetbagger, but he had lived in Georgia before the war and served as an officer in the Confederate Army. In the election of 1868, the Democratic conservatives attacked the Constitution because they claimed that it established social, political, and educational equality of whites and blacks, and that it would result in deprecation of property and a fearful increase of taxation. They declared it was framed by adventurers, convicts, and ignorant Negroes. Both parties appealed to the poor whites, the conservatives through race prejudice, and the Republicans by class prejudice. One of the latter appeals was, "Be a man. Let the slaveholding aristocracy no longer rule you. Vote for a constitution which educates your children free of charge, relieves the poor debtor from his rich creditor, allows a liberal homestead for your families, and more than all, places you on a level with those who used to boast that for every slave they were entitled to 3/5 of a vote in congressional representation. Ponder this well before you vote." The result of the election was mixed, but the conservative Democrats had 17 of the 44 members of the Senate and 88 of the 170 members of the House. There was evidence of fraud and intimidation of the Negroes in many counties where the Negroes were in the majority, and the electoral vote of the state was given to Seymour. In this legislature, 3 Negroes were elected to the Senate and 29 to the House. Bullock was installed as governor June 28th, but he complained to the military commander that many men ineligible to office under the 14th Amendment were seated in the legislature. The legislature investigated, but finally found none ineligible. The 14th Amendment was ratified July 21st. Georgia was duly restored to the Union by the Omnibus Bill, passed by Congress June 25, 1868. Military authority was withdrawn. 7 congressmen from Georgia were seated in the House, but the senators were elected too late to take their seats before Congress adjourned. Just as soon as congressional power was withdrawn, the Georgia legislature turned upon its Negro members, of whom there were 3 in the Senate and 29 in the House. Their presence was an offense. Former Governor Brown had maintained during the campaign that Negroes were not eligible to office, and the conservatives immediately took up the question, citing ex-Governor Brown's opinion and asking investigation. Led by Milton Candler, a white Democratic senator, a movement was started to declare that since Negroes were not citizens, they could not hold office. There was long and heated discussion. Bradley, one of the black senators, argued forcibly and ably in the Senate on the Negro's eligibility, and after his speech it was moved that Candler's resolutions be expunged from the minutes. Later, Bradley's own eligibility to his seat was attacked because of an alleged previous criminal conviction in New York. A majority of a special committee, all white men, sustained the accusation, but a minority declared that the evidence was incomplete. Nevertheless, Bradley was not allowed to defend himself and resigned. Thereupon, in September, the effort was continued to declare Campbell and Wallace, the other two colored senators, ineligible. The Negroes were given 1 hour for defense. After vigorous debate, the three colored senators were expelled by a vote of 24-11. The following protest was sent in by Wallace and Campbell. "We claim to be the legally elected representatives of a very large portion of, nearly one half of, the legal electors of the state of Georgia. Sirs, the Constitution and the laws of Georgia strictly provide that no laws shall be made or enforced which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States or of this state, or deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of its laws. Therefore, in behalf of ourselves, our constituents, and also in behalf of nearly 500,000 loyal citizens of this state, we do enter our solemn protest against the illegal, unconstitutional, unjust, and oppressive action of this body, based upon the resolutions of the senator from the 35th Senatorial District, declaring us ineligible on account of color." In the House, the resolution was introduced in August and passed in September by a vote of 83-23. The Negroes refused to vote. Four of the colored members, who were so white that their Negro blood could not be proven, were permitted to remain. They were Beard, Belcher, Davis, and Fayol. Turner made an elaborate defense of the right of the Negro to hold office. Cases may be found where men have been deprived of their rights for crimes and misdemeanors. But it has remained for the state of Georgia in the very heart of the 19th century to call a man before the bar and there charge him with an act for which he is no more responsible than for the head which he carries upon his shoulders. The Anglo-Saxon race, sir, is a most surprising one. No man has ever been more deceived in that race than I have been for the last 3 weeks. I was not aware that there was in the character of that race so much cowardice or so much pusillanimity. The Negro is here charged with holding office. Why, sir, the Negro never wanted office. I recollect that when we wanted candidates for the Constitutional Convention, we went from door to door in the Negro Belt and begged white men to run. Some promised to do so, and yet, on the very day of election, many of them first made known their determination not to comply with their promises. They told the black men everywhere that they would rather see them run. And it was this encouragement of the white men that induced the colored man to place his name upon the ticket as a candidate for the convention. In many instances, these white men voted for us. It is very strange if a white man can occupy on this floor a seat created by colored votes, and a black man cannot do it. Why, gentlemen, it is the most short-sighted reasoning in the world. If Congress has simply given me merely sufficient civil and political rights and made me a mere political slave for Democrats or anybody else, giving them the opportunity of jumping on my back in order to leap into political power, I do not thank Congress for it. Never, so help me God, shall I be a political slave. You have all the elements of superiority upon your side. You have our money and your own. You have our education and your own. You have our land, and your own too. We who number hundreds of thousands in Georgia, including our wives and families, with not a foot of land to call our own, strangers in the land of our birth, without money, without education, without aid, without a roof to cover us while we live, nor sufficient clay to cover us when we die. It is extraordinary that a race such as yours, professing gallantry, chivalry, education, and superiority, living in a land where ringing chimes call child and sire to the Church of God, a land where Bibles are read and gospel truths are spoken, and where courts of justice are presumed to exist. It is extraordinary, I say, that with all these advantages on your side, you can make war upon the poor, defenseless black man. This speech was not printed in the minutes of the legislature, but issued as a pamphlet in Augusta the same year. In September 1868, the legislature declared all colored members ineligible, and it then proceeded to put in their seats the persons who had received the next largest number of votes. The outrages of the Ku Klux Klan on Negroes and whites became widespread. Bullock protested and appealed to Congress, citing that members of the legislature had not all taken the test oath. Bullock's letter was accompanied by the memorial of the Convention of Colored People held in Macon in October. The Republicans brought the case to the state Supreme Court in June 1869. Two of the three judges decided that the Negroes were eligible. Immediately, there came the question as to whether this decision affected the legislature. Alexander Stephens and many others thought it did not. Negroes immediately began a movement to reseat their members. A closed convention was held at Macon with 136 delegates, many of whom walked from 10 to 40 miles to attend the meeting. The Constitution said that there were venomous and incendiary speeches, but these largely unlettered men went about to do their work of recovery of their privileges in extraordinarily practical ways. 82 counties were represented, and Turner presided. Reports of outrages and conditions were brought together and sent to Congress. Turner and Sims went to carry the report and relate their hardships before the Committee on Reconstruction. There was a disposition in Georgia to stand firm and not to reseat the Negroes. Several papers advised the Assembly to persist in the attitude which it had adopted, and to reseat the Negroes only under compulsion. In spite of such advice, Nelson Tift, Democratic representative-elect to Congress from the 2nd District, had pledged certain parties in Washington that Georgia would reseat the colored members and ratify the 15th Amendment if Congress would not interfere. This rumor ruined Tift's chance for a seat in Congress, for the Democrats said that they had not granted him such power and never would do so, for they did not intend to reseat the Negroes unless Congress should use force. Joshua Hill, one of the senators elected by the Georgia legislature in July, presented his credentials to the United States Senate, December 7, 1868. It was recommended that Hill be not admitted on the ground that Georgia had failed to comply with the Omnibus Act. In the House of Representatives, the Committee on Reconstruction was instructed to examine public affairs in Georgia. They took testimony during January 1869, hearing Governor Bullock, James Sims, a colored preacher, H.M. Turner, and others. The lawlessness in the treatment of blacks was emphasized, there being 260 cases of outrages between January and November. Meantime, there was a grave question as to whether Georgia's vote could be cast in the presidential election of 1868. It was finally decided that if Georgia's vote did not affect the result, the final vote should be announced in two ways, with and without the vote of Georgia. On a technicality, the members of the lower house who had already been representing Georgia were excluded as not entitled to sit in the 41st Congress. Several bills concerning Georgia were introduced into Congress. Finally, in March 1869, when Georgia refused to ratify the 15th Amendment, A bill was passed making the ratification of the 15th Amendment necessary before Georgia was admitted. The testimony as to the lawlessness in Georgia helped the passage of this bill, which became a law December 27, 1869. Georgia thus came again under military authority, and all persons elected to the legislature were called to meet in special session by General Meade. A legislature convened January 10th, and the test oath was administered under military supervision. This legislature ratified the 14th and 15th Amendments and not only recognized the 24 colored members, but paid them for lost time. There was thus a double expense for the salary of members that year, since both sets of members were paid, the white members on the motion of a colored senator. There was a question as to how long members of this legislature originally elected in 1869, but stopped by the expulsion of colored members, should hold office. And many attempts were made to bribe members of the legislature to secure their votes for and against prolonging their terms. Georgia members were admitted to the third session of the 41st Congress, and Georgia entered her third and final stage of Reconstruction January 10, 1870. The one colored congressman from Georgia, Jefferson Long, 1869 to 1871, opposed removing Confederate disabilities. Speaking in the House, he said February 1, 1871,